This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, book lovers, book critics, book writers. I'm Grant Faulkner, and I'm here with my book-loving co-host, Brooke Warner. Hey, Brooke.
Hey, Grant. I am excited about today's topic.
Yeah, me too. And about today's guest, John McMurtry. He's an esteemed former editor of the San Francisco Chronicle's book review section, which I read for many, many years while John was at the helm. And it was one of my main sources for news on new books, especially books from the Bay Area or California, in addition to the New York Times Sunday Book Review, which I've read religiously for decades. And John's going to tell us some tales from his years of reviewing and tell us just how books are chosen to be reviewed. But he's also got some unfortunate tales about the cuts book coverage has faced at nearly every newspaper and periodical in the country. For now, though, I want to go back to the halcyon days of book reviews when I'd open the Sunday Times each week and the books that were reviewed felt like they were changing the world. And they were all momentous to me in stature, and I studied the Times and the Chronicle's coverage. And other than wandering in bookstores and discovering books that way, the book reviews I read were really my main way to discover books. And I still read the Sunday Times book review, but the Chronicle no longer has a book review editor, so its book coverage is, you know, somewhat skimpier than it used to be or different. And if truth be told, I discover books in random ways on the internet now more than through any reviews and publications. And I was thinking that, Brooke, we both have an interesting generational lens on book reviews because a good portion of our lives were lived pre-internet. We've experienced, you know, both the before and the after, you know, the traditional review and the crowdsourced review. So I'm curious what role book reviews have played in your life as reader, editor, and publisher.
A huge role. And my heart did flutter a bit when you said the halcyon days, because, you know, those book review section was such a big part of my life at Seal Press. Mm-hmm. You know, I started there in 2004. So it was post-internet, but pre-social media just. I actually discovered it was coincident with, because Facebook started in 2004 also. And I was working at Seal when Twitter launched, and it took time, as people can probably remember, for social media to become so important to publishing. Mm-hmm. And that means that I still got to come of age during a time when reviews were king and when we were gunning for traditional media like TV and radio. And the San Francisco Chronicle's book review section was really like the end all be all in terms of local media. You know, I mean, we would just be so happy when a Seal book got a review there. It felt like the equivalent of Good Morning America. So, yeah, I can't really overstate how big of a deal traditional reviews were back then. But, you know, of course, now traditional reviews, they still matter, but maybe on par with online reviews.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because we're now living in a world where TikTok or BookTube reviews are the main ways for many people to discover books. And then there's Goodreads and Amazon reviews. And even though I don't know any of the reviewers on Goodreads and Amazon, but it's amazing what a predominance of five-star reviews will do for a book's, you know, credibility and clout if I don't know much about it. And I'm just you know, kind of perusing books. But that said, you know, I think a big part of me is influenced by the status a book gets when it's noted by a prestigious publication like the Times. And I recently read a piece by the British sociologist John Thompson, and he studies the influence of media on society. And he identified five resources of capital that are essentially essential for publishing success in his book, which is titled Merchants of Culture, the Publishing Business in the 21st Century. And he wrote that besides cash, the most important resource is what he calls symbolic capital, which he defines as the accumulated prestige and status associated with the publishing house. So to deconstruct this a little bit, new authors, and perhaps especially self-published authors, start with little to no symbolic capital because they simply aren't known. So they have to work to create that capital. And one key way to do so is through book reviews, which are important even for books with the capital from the esteemed publishing houses that publish them. You know, so book reviews are important for social proof as well as getting marketing opportunities. strategies like, you know, BookBub placement or, you know, mining quotes for ad copy. So this is a big question for a new author and indie author and many other authors, actually, is how do you go about building up symbolic capital, especially through reviews? So I'm very curious about what you advise, Brooke. You know, do you hire a publicist? Do you pay Kirkus for a review? Do you work hard on getting book bloggers to cover your book? All the above?
Yes to all of the above. For us, reviews continue to be very important to the campaign of a given book, and most of those campaigns are managed by traditional publicists. We encourage authors now to focus on the big five trade reviews. Those are Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, Booklist, Library Journal, and Forward. And all of those, if you qualify, you can submit without paying, but they don't choose a whole lot of books. I mean, we're going to talk about this, you know, just the influx of books. And so for the unpaid reviews, very few get chosen. And so if any of our books do not get chosen, I do recommend that authors pay for reviews, which, you know, is a whole other subject. And then there are other outlets too, of course, Shelf Awareness, Midwest Book Review, Lambda, Blue Ink, you know, just to name a few where our authors get reviewed. That are just a little bit more traditional in terms of their focus and how they operate as traditional review outlets. And then I do think they hold more clout, of course, than a given blog site might, just because they've been around for a long time. They're specifically for reviews. They're recognizable names. And they're really important to the library market. And if you're a self-published author, then the library market is pretty hard to penetrate. But for us, it's a big deal. And part of the reason that we care about reviews as much as we do is really for the penetration of books into libraries, which has nothing to do with Amazon or Barnes & Noble or even indie bookstores.
I think the task for a new writer is to think about how symbolic capital might be created in ways other than traditional book reviews. And one way to plant the initial seeds of symbolic capital, sorry, I'm using that term all the time, is to recruit readers who, you know, essentially become your advanced reader team. And these are people who you can send your new books to before launch and ask them to review on publication. And to recruit these readers, you know, you can send an email to friends and family, of course, to see if they'll be on your review team. Or if you have a larger list and have been, you know, have a newsletter that you're putting out, you can ask for book review volunteers via your newsletter or social media. So also these days, I think it's not all about getting your book reviewed in a newspaper, because there's so many book blogs out there. And so it's worth researching who are the main bloggers covering your genre and then building a relationship with them. And it should be noted, though, that it's good to reach out, you know, 4 to 6 months before your book comes out, you know, to get the reviews in place. A lot of review publications, even book blogs, they want to review the book, you know, in real time as it's launching. And, you know, the symbolic capital might not be as great via a book blog, but it's still capital, you know, and capital, it's capital that you can spend and invest and build it into something bigger. So I don't think you need to like think like if you don't get a review in the newspaper, it's like an all or nothing scenario. It's more about building that capital over time. But we're talking about this all from a book sales and discovery angle, Brooke, and the book review section of a newspaper also has the purpose of being a cultural arbiter, you know, of covering ideas and tastes and news-breaking books. So the task of a book editor and their team is to essentially curate, you know, our reading buffet. So my question is, are we losing something by losing these traditional places of taste-making and idea spreading? You know, do our new, more democratic ways of reading about books lead us to better places on a general cultural level?
Yeah, the jury is still out on this for me. I guess I just don't know yet. On the one hand, I feel a lot of sadness and nostalgia around newspaper reviews and how many of them are gone or just slashed way back. John spoke to, you know, the fact that so many editors got laid off at the Los Angeles Times recently. It hurts me, you know, because I think that these are really important institutions. I still read the book section of the New York Times as you do. Other traditional media sites too, like The Guardian and NPR, you know, these places are meaningful to me and many, many, many others. I think what's happening is across a lot of the country that people don't trust their news sources as much as they used to. And so a lot of ways, it's also the loss of clout of those places, of those news institutions, in addition to the splintering of media that has caused this major shift. So people trust individual voices. People trust the people they trust. And I think that's why Substack is taking off in the way that it is. I mean, Twitter self-combusted. And then all of these people are taking to this platform that is so un-Twitter-like, right, with its expectation of article writing. And really, it's becoming a news source. I'm reading more people on Substack on a regular basis than I am the magazines I've subscribed to, like The Atlantic or The New Yorker. And then cultural arbiters have historically had to be given a platform, and now they don't. They can create their own. So that's something interesting. You mentioned democracy. I do love the democratization of that. You know, it's exciting to me. And the reason I finally started my Substack, I mean, in addition to being inspired by you and other people, Grant, was actually because I wrote an article about KKR's purchase of Simon & Schuster. And I tried to get it placed traditionally and no one would publish it. And I was like, I really want this out in the world, so I'm going to publish it myself. And it got a lot of traction, you know, right out the gate. And all of this appeals to me, of course, because I'm a green light. You know, it's my thing to encourage people not to wait for the powers that be to tell them that their stuff is good enough. So I guess I'm saying it's like both and, because as much as I feel the loss of these outlets, I also feel that these outlets are often not democratic and what gets chosen is highly subjective. Many voices get left out. You know, historically, that's true, of course, and it's based on problematic isms. And yeah, I just think with the splintering of media, that maybe we're better at curating our tastes because there are more offerings. But like I said, I mean, I think I'm still wrangling with it all in my head.
Yeah. In some ways, as I was listening to you talk, I think like we're kind of living in this interesting golden age where we get both, you know?
Yeah.
Like The Atlantic did put out this big list of, I don't think they said they were the best novels. They just said they were interesting novels, and there were 130 American novels, you know, and the list, you know, to make a list, it's not like it used to be to make a list. They didn't make it to be a canon. They made it to be a thought-provoking list and a list to argue with and have a conversation with. And so, you know, in some ways, I think that that's the role that publications play, is like is kind of planting the seeds of conversations. But on the other hand, we have this all these great tools. And like you, I've had things that I couldn't publish traditionally, or just because I didn't have access to publications, or by the time I might get access, whatever I was going to write was going to be out of date, you know?
Right.
So that's where Substack, it becomes very handy, because I can write it and publish it right away. And yeah, have an audience, maybe not as big of an audience, but at least have some sort of like conversation with readers. So it's really, really interesting times we're in. And John has some great perspectives on our times. And so looking forward to talking to him right after this really short break. Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to introduce John McMurtry, who has worked as an editor and writer for more than three decades. And a particular note, from 2008 to 2019, he was the books editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, where he wrote, assigned, and edited literally thousands of pieces, including reviews, essays, and profiles. And he's now an independent book editor and a senior editor at the San Francisco-based literary journal Zizifa. And John also edits for McSweeney's Publishing and the literary travel magazine Stranger's Guide. And his writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and Literary Hub. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Grant. Thanks very much. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, it's a treat. And John, I know you've told me stories that, if I remember right, that you used to literally fill a room with the books that you received from publishers and publicists and authors at the San Francisco Chronicle, and that you obviously couldn't possibly review even a fraction of them. So I was always very interested in like how you chose what to review. How does a book, you know, reach the level of being reviewable? Do you just throw a dart at the stack?
That's the big question. And actually, that was, I think there were two rooms. There was this inner sanctum. Mm. There was one room where everything just came in. And then the inner one was where I put books that I wanted to have a closer look at.
Mm.
And so if you put aside half the things that came in that were either self-published or romance novels, oh my goodness, people just sent in everything, including food and booze, cheap booze.
Wow.
Yeah.
You can write your own memoir about being a book reviewer.
Let me woo you here by like including half broken cookies that were baked in God knows what year, along with this galley. That's not going to do it, maybe. So that is the big question. There is only so much room, of course. Yes. Yeah, so the pile to go through it. You know, I think I there was a book section. So I thought of it, broadly speaking, in terms of what would fill those pages. And I wanted to pull back and see that we had a good representation, say, between different genres and subject matters, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, occasionally an essay in there, and whether we had good representation among authors, new authors, people who deserved another look, underrepresented authors. Did I say that? Yes. Regional authors. I thought the cool thing is, you know, it's such a rich landscape, the Bay Area, San Francisco, such great talent here. So if I focused only on the Bay Area, that would have worked. Hmm. And I also wanted to find voices who were overlooked and to steer clear, if possible, of bigger titles. So
interesting.
That's part of it.
What an interesting challenge.
Yes.
I can imagine those rooms because I've been to Publishers Weekly, and this was maybe more like pre-pandemic, but they would, I mean, really like their walls were stacks of books, right? It's just such an interesting space to walk around in, but also slightly disheartening. To Grant's point, like yeah. Too many, right? Yeah. But we have seen a seismic shift in the world of book reviews because of the internet, of course, and in a world where everyone can now be a book reviewer simply by posting a review on Amazon or a TikTok video, or even just a simple post on social media. I'm curious what you think the role of the traditional book reviewer is, you know, one who's still publishing in a publication, and how important that continues to be to the industry or and to authors.
Yeah, the traditional gatekeepers, there are fewer of them. And given, for instance, that the LA Times, now it's been 2 or 3 months, I think, that they laid off, what, more than 100 people, including the book's editor, Boris Koshka, who did an excellent job. That was quite unfortunate, to say the least. So people, authors, they have to find, I mean, I'm trying to think of it from the perspective of, if you have a book out, what to do. So it's both frightening and exciting, I would think. I would embrace that opportunity to go with technology and see what that could yield versus just dismissing it out of hand. Because I think there are probably possibilities that I just don't know about.
I think one thing that I'm curious about, I'll just ask a follow-up question, is you know, the book review section was an arbiter of tastes, you know, and sort of made the decision. These, you know, every Sunday, whether it was the Chronicle or the New York Times, you'd open it up and you'd be like, these books are important. These are the books I need to reckon with, you know?
Right,
and
right.
So as we experience, like, book sections being cut, like the LA Times book section, you know, like, is there a chasm there? Do we need that guidance?
I think it certainly helps. It's just getting books in front of readers that matters for so much. And I think the problem isn't with the journalists doing this work, writing the reviews and profiles and Q&As. It's up to the people who run the websites and the business side of things to present this to readers. And to the Times has done a good job, I think, of really promoting stories about books routinely above the fold, as it were, you know, above now it's the homepage of websites, the equivalent of above the fold. They just did this for within the past few days on the most recent, or I think it was the 22 best comic novels since Catch 22. And they really gave it great attention, along with new paperbacks to look at. And they did this whole multimedia box with different features, interviews with journalists, talking about books. So this was cool to see that they're playing it up. And so I think just as the newspaper, the print product, as much as we can bemoan its loss, and inherent within that is the print section, we have to admit that newspapers, websites, and magazines as well, The Atlantic, New Yorker, still love the print product, but the New Yorker online is a better thing than the printed newspapers. There's so much more you can do, and it's, of course, more up to date, but you've got audio, video, and all these features to accompany
right.
The standard coverage.
Well, John, I've been invited to write a few reviews in my lifetime, and oftentimes I have to say no because they pay so badly, I have to confess. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, it's a lot of work to write a good review. You know, you read the book and then you have to write the review, and, you know, there's the money involved. And so I was just curious to know, you know, how do you shape a review as an editor? Like, what makes a good review? But then how do you even really get good reviewers these days? I guess that's the other thing, is like, if you have your own Substack or you're doing it on Goodreads, you're perhaps incentivized because you're sort of building your own following as opposed to writing for someone else.
It's not a good way to make a living. No, that's not the way to do it. It's really a passion. It should be a passion that people have, and that it shouldn't be laborious. And I need to get some more reviews so that I can, you know, pay for my groceries. It's so often the people I dealt with were either authors or academics or people in professional and just various realms that this was fun for them. So it was not at all about the money. The money is awful. It's true at most places, but it's never about that. And some people, you know, you would hound them about, wait, we owe you money. And no, just I'll do it for free. And that's mighty generous of them, but, it's usually not going to make a difference in people's lives. But I think you were asking about what I look for in a review. Is that right, Brooke?
Yeah. Or when you're working with a review editor, what would you say really makes a, what would you say to look for that stands out?
Sure. I think beyond just the standard, tell me a little bit about what the book is about, of course, to not go overboard on plot description. And to, I think most importantly, to give the author a fair shake. And I don't know if you've seen these, I don't know if they were established by Updike, John Updike's rules per se, but he had a good list probably several decades ago now. I think probably somebody's, it has to exist online, of just standards that one could abide by. And really the thing I remember most is, and that seems just, is to really think about what the author intended in writing the book, to consider that. That's so important. It's so easy to knock a book. And I think maybe there's less of that now, but it's too easy for someone to make their name by taking someone down and thinking they're doing it in a clever way. So I think really to, humor, of course, is a good thing if it warrants it, but it shouldn't be too self-regarding, and you got to be careful with how you play it. But that was always an easy thing in a review to take out. If something raised a red flag, if it was either litigious or you're just being snarky for the sake of being snarky. Mm-hmm. And often the review would be fine without that little line there, that zinger. And voice too, if again appropriate, voice really helps in the piece. And also, you know, first person pieces, I think people who probably are older than I am would say, oh, you don't want that. But I think it really pulls the reader in. So often it's a case of matching the reviewer with the book in a certain way that they've had this lived experience that they can talk about personally. And that's cool. I like that. So getting all that in 800 words.
It's interesting, John, that you said that writing a negative review or a takedown review can be easier to do in some ways. And you also mentioned that the negative reviews, maybe there are fewer of them these days. And that's my sense too, is that there used to be sort of almost a tradition of the person who maybe fell in love with their negative voice or taking down an author. I don't know how to express it, but it's interesting to hear you talk about, like, your goal is to give the author a fair shake.
Yeah, I think so.
But I'm just kind of curious, like, there is also, from the reader standpoint, like, we want to know if a book isn't worth reading.
Sure.
You know? So how do you deal with that negative review?
Well, also I was going to say too, that there's the flip side too, that there are many reviews out there where I sense that the person's not being as critical as they could be.
Ah, yeah.
Either it's that they want to cozy up to someone in a strange way.
Yeah.
Or they don't want to, they fear being on someone's shit list. That they're just being overly shy or cautious. So you do want to not think about the audience at large. I mean, you want to think about the reader, but not out of concern of who am I going to offend here in that sense. If you truly don't like this, and you've explained it well. But there are any number of great negative reviews from which you can learn something, to your point. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're not going to buy the book, but they're a joy to read. And sometimes there's a parallel with obituaries where it's a life story. And maybe it's more with nonfiction works. You might not have known about this person's life were it not for this obituary. And reviews are really a window into the world, the way that journalism is, and books just have that power. So you get to learn a little bit about a lot of different things. That's what I always loved about journalism.
Mm-hmm. One place where I just want to say that about negative reviews that I still think it's happening from time to time. You know, I do see the New York Times kind of pitting people against each other every once in a while with memoir.
Yeah,
I follow memoir, you know, so I think there is still a little bit of a tradition. It's almost like they choose the worst possible person to review the book. You know, someone who has like an opposing lifestyle, like, you know, someone who's a serial monogamist reviewing a book about polyamory, you know, right. Something to that effect. Right. So it's just interesting. But I'm curious about, lots of times you'll see in major review sections, other well-known writers writing about other books, you know, by well-known writers. So there's that tradition. But in terms of people who really love book reviewing for passion, I mean, do you think starting your own blog, doing a Substack, you know, reviewing for Goodreads is a good way in? And how would you recommend someone break into more traditional reviewing?
Oh, certainly. I think those are all good things. I think hounding newspapers, you know, I'm thinking now of something I haven't thought of in years, but I had a review assigned to a published, no names, novelist, and he turned it in, and it was a tight deadline. I had this thing scheduled, and it was quite bad to the point where I couldn't rework it, and I had to tell him, I'm sorry, I can't run this. And I was expecting him to say, to react quite strongly. But strangely, I think, actually, he felt, oh, that's fine. That's fine with me. Mm. He wasn't so wedded to what he had written. Mm. But right at that time, as if handed to me on a silver plate, was a total stranger who had sent me a review unsolicited of the same book. And it was so well done. Mm. And I said, thank you, thank you, thank you. I am running this and it's beautiful. And then she became a reviewer. She was in my stable and then has since become a published novelist. And so that's only because she wrote to me out of the blue. And so I did answer people. I would, it wasn't just me soliciting potential reviewers. I got a lot of email from people. I mean, it works this way with submissions for people, right? Submitting to journals. They're looking to.
Absolutely.
To have their, find a home for their thing. So it's the same business with reviews. So there are perhaps fewer traditional venues, but that doesn't mean that one can't find any number of them online, certainly. And that as a way to just get better at it, as with any writing, the more you do it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's such a strange little form, as I was saying, you can be a great novelist, but you might not be able to write a review so well.
Well, on that note, I'm going to flip it, flip the question. After being such a reviewing so many books and overseeing so many reviews of books, give us John McMurtry's top things that make a book good.
Oh, I think the things that you all know, but just being able to having it make you turn the pages without you being aware that you're doing that. I was considering a short story that someone had written, and they were asking me, they thought it was too long. And I guess in retrospect, I thought, yeah, it is a little long as a short story, but I wasn't aware of it at all as I was reading it. Hmm. I loved it. So page to page, I was lost within it. So if you can, you know, that's a sort of magic, but if you can create that, And, you know, there's creative nonfiction where you're, it's essentially the writing's like a novel. So that kind of pace has to exist. So to that, I would say, of course, characters that are fully fleshed, if you're writing about a novel. So I edit manuscripts. That's part of what I do on the side. And sometimes I think characters exist in an author's mind and they have a sense of them, but I, as a reader, don't know who they're talking about really. Mm-hmm. So I try to encourage them to give me some more details or something specific about this person that, I want to know who this person is. So strong dialogue as well. That, you know, I love Elmore Leonard. And Richard Price, two masters at the form. So with fiction, you know, it doesn't have to be pages and pages of this, but that can make a difference if it's, especially if it's humorous and being surprised, being told a story that is unfamiliar to me. I was thinking, you know, along the lines of these comic novels that I mentioned, I don't know that James McBride's novel was included in the bunch. And there was also the Atlantic list.
Yeah, big list.
The Great American Novel, something like this. So The Good Lord Bird, a novel I've loved for years by James McBride, of having a long set piece with Frederick Douglass being a very profane and repulsive figure, very much not like the Frederick Douglass that we traditionally know. Hmm. And I just love that because it was out of left field completely. So, and I'm also looking forward to reading Percival Everett's new novel, James. And, you know, it's dangerous maybe to do a retelling of a novel, a traditional novel, a beloved novel. But if done well, that I want to read, especially if it's fun. Mm-hmm. So something new, fresh. It's not yet another novel about somebody in his 20s who's struggling with life on the Upper East Side of New York and the usual sort of whatever it is.
John, that's the novel I'm working on, actually.
It's going to be so much better, Graham.
Yeah. Frederick Douglass might make an appearance somewhere in there.
It's speculative fiction, yeah. That's the thing.
I hope so.
That was great, John. Thanks so much for your insights on book reviews.
Yeah, thanks so much, John.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
We'll be right back after this short break with today's book trend.
Well, Brooke, since we're talking about book reviews and how we find out about books and take part in a reading community, there are a couple of TikTok topics to touch base on. How's that for alliteration? Did I say that right? TikTok topics. The House passed a bill recently that would force TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance, to divest or sell the platform or be banned in the U.S. And that's important for the book world because of the immense influence of book talk, which we've talked about here before. So if TikTok is banned or under different ownership, which might change the platform's functionality, influencers who depend on the platform will be left to, you know, migrate elsewhere, you know, maybe Instagram Reels. So I'm curious if a new platform will bring on maybe a new book conversation, because a lot of the book talk on TikTok is focused on teens and especially teenage girls.
Yeah, and Kathleen Schmidt, who we very recently had on as a guest, has a good take on this in her recent newsletter. She wrote, "What worries me is the industry's reliance on TikTok and other platforms for marketing. Publishers depend on other people's business models, government oversight, and some erratic CEOs to get books in front of consumers. The truth is that no one knows when a social media platform will be sold. Look at what happened to Twitter or shut down. Does book publishing have a plan B? I doubt it, and that's a problem." I totally agree with this take, Grant. I mean, it is a really interesting thing, this reliance on these platforms. And now we're seeing a lot of volatility in this space.
Yeah, I thought Kathleen's point, the publishers should develop their own platforms so they don't have to be at the mercy of other social media platforms, was, you know, super interesting. At the same time, and her, to be fair, like she actually, like I got clarity on what she meant by that in our interview. She was really saying they should come together. and do it as a consortium. And when I initially read her comments, I didn't see it working or happening because I thought of like, oh, Penguin Random House will have their own platform and, you know, whatever, HarperCollins will have their own.
Right.
But it made sense on a certain level for them to come together as a consortium. I think the challenge there is that so many people, our online lives happen on our preferred social media platform. So it is a big ask for people to also go to one other specific place just to talk about books.
Well, that's true, undoubtedly. And yet, I think a lot of these people, I mean, my silo of Substack is almost exclusively about books, you know, so it's like this broader industry and people talking about maybe broader culture, who knows, but it's an interesting point or exploration, I guess I should say. And people have a lot of strong feelings about social media, no matter what. I mean, that would be another reason why it would be quite a hard thing to enter into TikTok in particular for all kinds of reasons. On the positive side, it's introduced a momentous historical conversation about books that happened organically. You know, readers drove that, not publishing companies. On the other hand, there are downsides to consider. And this comes from a recent Book Riot article that detailed about Book Talk. It said basically, Book Talk is more about the aesthetic of being a reader than it is about the actual reading. Book Talk promotes the same 20 or so books that they're all fluffy nonsense. Book Talk forms a sort of gatekeeping, whether purposeful or accidental, that determines what a book lover should look like or how many books they should own. I think that's a pretty valid take from what I've seen. I mean, I'm a little bit judgmental of Book Talk and I'm not on there. You know, it's less likely to show creators and authors of color in feeds. That's been a major criticism. It tends to promote primarily white authors. You know, I know Black creators who are really frustrated by TikTok in general. And, you know, of course, for us, Grant, we know that it also skews pretty much toward a younger audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely have a ways to go, Brooke, as we learn every week. And we want to do our part by continuing this conversation, and we want to broaden this conversation. I actually just heard from a listener yesterday, and he told me that he listened to Right Minded throughout October and November, and it helped him finish NaNoWriMo. So we hope you keep listening so that you can start and complete whatever writing project you want to bring to fruition. We'll see you next week.